Hello, today is Thursday, November 12th, 2015. This is an oral history interview with Malala Chikasa Anana. We're at her home in Madison, Wisconsin. My name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. Also present is Michaela Sullivan Fowler from the Ebeling Library on the UW-Madison campus. So when we last left off, we were getting ready to talk to you about coming to Madison.
Oh, okay.
So why don't we just keep going with that, and then we'll see where that leads us.
Okay. We left Boston for Jim to join the music faculty at UW-Madison. And as I said, we were living in Roxbury, right in this urban city, with all of this very various nuances and energy and liveliness, and the challenges of living where people are dense. And we came out here. It was just the opposite. I was so lonely. I miss seeing all the people in Boston. It was an easier life out here. But I stood in my picture window for days wanting to see, where are the people? When are they going to start walking? Where are the grocery carts? I just couldn't believe that people stayed in their houses and they didn't go out to the grocery store or the car wash or whatever. So a neighbor came over. We came here on October 30th. And all my four kids were worried about this Halloween. Would they have Halloween in Madison, Wisconsin? So we did have Halloween. It poured rain. It was cold, but the kids went out anyway. And the neighbors came over and introduced themselves. And one neighbor in particular, Helen Bukelic, was determined that I would like it here and I would settle there. She just passed away October 2nd. So we had remained friends all that time. But she was very proactive in seeing that I got settled here. I told her. I said, this is okay, but where are the black people? So she introduced me to the south side of Madison. And I met some black families. And no sooner had we gotten settled in than somebody burned a cross on our lawn. It frightened my children. And in the South, burning a cross has a special meaning. Of course, you know it's done by the Ku Klux Klan or somebody with that mentality. And a couple of my black friends came over and spent the night looking out the picture window, daring those Ku Klux Klanners to come back. But what frightened me is it hadn't been too long since I had been down south, and the burning of the cross simply means we're coming, was a forewarning, and that we will be back to burn down things. So that was my introduction to, quote, liberal Madison. the police came, but they didn't make much of it. They just said, that was because my children had made somebody mad. So that's the way they dismissed it. It was a little article about that big in the newspaper. But a couple of things happened after that. All the neighbors put together a petition that said if one of us is in danger, all of us are in danger. And it was signed by all, as many neighbors as I could think of, as I could see. And for days they brought us food. So it was their way of saying, you're welcome here. We do have a nutcracker somewhere in the neighborhood, but we want you to stay here. Of course, we were the only black family in that neighborhood and neighborhoods surrounding that neighborhood. It was called the, it's over by Crest Funeral Home, or Hillcrest Drive. And I can't, it had a name, Sunset Hills neighborhood. I understand that just before we came, they had gotten rid of some kind of covenant clause in their association notes that prohibited black people and Jewish people from living in that neighborhood. So that was one introduction. 45 years later, I often wonder where those people are who burned the cross. Mm-hmm. And have they thought about what they were doing? I was really frightened. And on the other hand, I was comforted by knowing that the neighbors said, we've got your back. So, I resumed my activism in Madison. The university women wanted me to join them, but I wasn't comfortable doing that. Tea and cookies were not my thing. Back then, I was a dutiful housewife and mother, which I never regret. And I got a chance to stay home with my five kids until the youngest was in kindergarten. But the State Historical Society, I learned, had an exhibit of black history in their building. It was down in the basement of the building. So I went to look at it, and I was shocked at the ignorance that it portrayed and how shallow it was. These historians had taken, had clipped some pages about slavery and cotton fields from Life magazine and scotch taped them on the wall and decided to call this our history. So I went to see the people at the Historical Society and told them I thought this was not a good representation of what black history was. It took us about 2 years, but in the end, first of all, they tore down that, disassembled that exhibit, and then they put some of their best designers and historians and archivists on really doing a really nice exhibit of black history. They had diorama boxes that represented different eras. They went back to Africa. The honorable slaves were part of the history, but was so much more of what we had achieved and contributed. And I asked them to bring in a well-known historian. I can't remember his name right now. He died, maybe 15 or 20 years ago. I went to his funeral down in Georgia. I happened to be vacationing in Atlanta, and he died. I'll think of his name. He's a brilliant historian. He came to keynote our program. And so that was one of the things that we did. We organized a group and brought Gwendolyn Brooks here so our kids could see a Pulitzer poet. And we had a program over at the, it was called the South Madison Neighborhood Center at that time. I never really could, back in those days, get the community too much interested in the kind of activism I thought was necessary to expose some of the racism and discriminatory practices in Madison.
Malele, at that time, were you involved, or did you work with the students on campus that were...
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I supported them. And I walked in protest with them many days, many, many days.
Was this the early 1970s?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. I came here in 68. So by 69, the Dow chemical protests were in full swing. And as much as I can remember, there was a protest every single day on campus.
Sounds Madison-y.
Mm-hmm. So when you decided to travel across town, you had to build in that time of getting around the protesters. Bascom Hill was busy all day, all week. And the kids even found the chancellor's house, the president's house, which is different than the chancellor's house. And they would sit in there and have protests. And so and the black students were quite active. I've seen a couple of those black students come back to the campus, maybe in the 90s or early 2000. And what was so disheartening about the student protest is that the black students were here on scholarship, and the university denied them their scholarship after they were identified as the leaders of the protest. I can't remember the names of the students right now. Maybe it will come back to me. But that was a very sad day that the professors failed them in their classes, and the university dismiss their scholarships. I wish I could think of this guy's name. He was a huge guy. And he led the protesters over the bullhorns. And at that time, they didn't have the tight security and the sophisticated technology, GPS, to track the protesters. So the police never knew what the kids were going to do. And they'd have a meeting, say, on Thursday night for a protest on Friday, and they would say, and we'll let you know where the protest is going to be and what route it's going to take. And it really frustrated the officials. Now they have surveillance equipment on top of roofs and GPS tracking systems and a monitoring room downtown with cameras on the streets. But they didn't have that back then, so the kids were pretty good in not letting the police know where they were going to assemble next, or what their route was, as they maneuvered through campus and into downtown. They had a pretty good, effective strategy for that.
Malele, do you know if white students lost their scholarships and professors failed them as well, those that were involved in
protests? I guess not. I don't know that. And the black student protests never did merge too well with the anti-war protests. So there was the anti-war protests and the black student protests. And they were protesting because there were very few, if any. They wanted more black professors, and they wanted to initiate the Afro-American Studies program.
Okay.
Those were their two main goals. All the protests, there were several factors that caused the protests to come to a halt. One, of course, was the student leaders lost their means of survival here. Kwame Salter was one of those. But there were some others. I just can't think of their names right now. I can see them. The other chief factors was the bombing of Sterling Hall. That really brought a halt to the protest movement here on campus. I think that occurred in 71 or 72. And I lived probably 5 miles, 8 miles from the campus. And that night we heard the bombing and some pictures fell off the wall.
Wow.
So that was unfortunate. Carlton Armstrong and his companions set off a bomb in Sterling Hall, I think it was the chemistry building. And one professor, a graduate student, was in that building that night. And he lost his life. That whole incident dampened the spirit of protest. In 1974, I ran for school board. I won the election. I had a good support team. And I was the first black person to be elected to a school board in the state of Wisconsin. Then the following year, the mayor appointed me as affirmative action officer for the city of Madison. It's a very strategic job. I wasn't the first affirmative action officer. There was a white woman who preceded me. That position taught me a lot. I learned a lot. But it was very harmful to both my emotional and mental health and physical being. I didn't know the city was not ready to offer equal opportunity to black people for jobs. So the resistance in City Hall was strong. And the resistance, we had two parts, employment at City Hall, and the other part was employment on with firms that had city contracts, particularly the construction industry. It was just, it was a terrible resistance. What was this man's name? I should never forget his name. He was head of the union. And he was bound and determined that they weren't not going to, his unions were not going to employ black men. And he put up all kinds of resistant efforts, all kinds of obstacles. I remember one time we had, were trying to work with the unions and called a community meeting where people could get an idea of what kind of jobs there were. And they brought in a wrench. It must have been 3 feet long.
A literal wrench.
Right.
Yeah. Wow.
And it was from about from this patio door down to that statue. Must have weighed a ton. And it's something that they do use in underground plumbing and streets. But they wanted, they use this to demonstrate how difficult these jobs were. Probably only use that twice a year and in very specific situations. The thing that saved me was that Paul Sovlin became not only a mentor, but he supported the Affirmative Action Office. So we were able to get quite a few black people. There wasn't a Hispanic population at that time. Quite a few black people hired. Some of those people are retiring, have retired in the past few years. And they are very grateful for our efforts. But it was tough. Paul used to tell me, he says, we're not trying to change standards. We're just doing them differently. As an affirmative action officer, I'd laid out a plan for the city's first equal opportunity plan. A big thick book. I brought in national consultants. I talked to department heads. I was on the mayor's management team. But resistance was a mile thick. Only David Cooper and the police department were cooperative. Everybody else thought it was reverse discrimination. That was a big part of the resistance. There was a guy who won a Supreme Court case claiming reverse discrimination, that affirmative action was reverse discrimination. So those were probably the most difficult years. in my entire career. I finally decided that I didn't want to stay in affirmative action. So I was able to work through a friend and got appointed. Got a job with Procter & Gamble in Cincinnati, Ohio. I moved my family there. I didn't know anything about working in a corporation or a private business, because I had either worked in schools or for government. So that was a big eye-opener for me. I was in the organizational development unit at Procter & Gamble, and its Cincinnati headquarters. I worked in an administrative building. As a matter of fact, it was called the Hillcrest Building. And I did a lot of training in time management, anger and conflict management, that kind of thing. I enjoyed that a lot. And it was not without its moments of discrimination. I remember in the middle of a training session, maybe at 10:30 in the morning, two of the engineers that we were working with in this organizational development class decided to interrupt the class and question my credentials. I remember another time, a guy interrupted the class. He wanted to know if black women were sexy.
Sexy.
So that didn't happen all the time, but they were like, when those kind of things happen, when you're trying to do your job and somebody decides to be foolish, it's a major distraction, and sometimes you begin to doubt yourself. And really, at the time it's happening, and it's like at the time it's happening, you don't realize it for what it is, because you're focused on making the best presentation you can. And there's this curveball that you're being thrown that's coming at you. It's only on reflection that you see how foolish it was. And on, so it prepares you for the next time a curveball is being thrown your way. I stayed in organizational development for a couple of years in Cincinnati, and then I was transferred to Green Bay in the plant production. They make toilet tissue at that time. They had a huge, two huge plants that made most all of the company's toilet tissue and paper towels. At that time, Procter & Gamble had about 75 products. I think today they probably have 300. But they were mainly in soap and soap coffee and paper products. So I was asked to lead the Bounce program unit of the plant. It was a very small operation, believe it or not, even though Bounce made millions of dollars for the company. So all we did was take a thin piece of paper and coat it with wax. The machines were coated with wax. It was a big money maker. But in that experience, I learned about business. I learned about marketing. I learned about quality control. I learned about the production process. And it was probably, it was a hard experience, but it's probably the best learning I'd had since college. Because I saw the whole and then the parts. And private business approaches things much differently than government. First of all, you have to make money, so you have to be very aware of your numbers all the time. In government, you're given a budget and you don't know where the, you're not concerned with where the dollars come from, and you work with that budget. It's the opposite in private business. Your goal is to make money, be efficient, and save costs. So that was a whole new experience for me. Oh, one that I appreciate to this day. I wouldn't be in business today if it had not been for that Procter & Gamble experience. Because it opened my eyes to a world that I had never been exposed to in no form or fashion. P&G employees are some of the brightest people in the world. And P&G as a company at that time was known as the best training grounds for people. The problem with P&G employees is they're all so smart, and they all think they're the next vice president or president. So I don't know what the company is like today, but back then, it was the Harvard of the manufacturing world. So I left P&G and set out to do business on my own. It was just about the time that the PC, or the small computer, was making waves.
The mid-80s?
The mid-80s and 83, I think. And I hung out my shingle as a trainer in the PC world. Mm-hmm. Took me a little time to get off the ground. And but I was able to make a comfortable living for my family. I still had three kids. By that time, I was divorced. And of the five kids, two finished college, and was the last two that I took care of. And was that I brought a lot of the knowledge, business knowledge, on how to construct things and develop business strategies from P&G. And I didn't find a lot of prejudice and discrimination in the business world. Not that it didn't exist. It's just that I was offering for the first time white people something that they had no idea what to do with, how it existed, how it functioned. So, but of course I didn't like Green Bay because I was so isolated. You could go for weeks and not see a black person. Green Bay itself was pretty prejudiced. When I first got transferred there, I went there in the summertime for a short stay. And the housing situation was really bad, you know. You see an ad in the paper or on TV and you go there and they'd have a lot of limp excuses as to why the apartment was not available. And that happened to me in Cincinnati, too. I wanted to move from one place to another place. And I was very methodical. I had three kids, and I was very methodical. And being a P&G executive and making these moves. But every time I call a house or go by or knock on the door, suddenly nobody was at home. Or they'd hang up on you once they detected that you were a black person. So I said to my kids one evening, I said, you know, I've tried to get maybe 12 or 15 apartments. I said, the next joker that denies me an apartment, I'm going to do something different. So Saturday morning, I looked in the paper, and there was, seemed to be a nice apartment, a duplex, not far from where I was living. So I called, and the man said, yes, it was available. And he'd be happy to show me. I said, I'll be there in 5 minutes. Back then, as middle management, you know, you wore your, you weren't casual in your dress, you wore your suits and business clothes. So I put on my business clothes and went to see this apartment. Mind you, it was only 5 minutes away. And the man came to the door. He met me on the sidewalk and said, oh, I'm so sorry. This apartment, somebody just came and rented it. I am so sorry. Yeah, I know I talked to you on the phone. But they liked it and they wanted it. Oh, I said, oh. As I was getting in my car, I said, I wonder how that happened in 5 minutes. So having been in affirmative action, I felt that this was a case of discrimination. So I went home and I called some of my white friends at P&G and asked them if they would go try to rent the apartment with the same attributes that I would have, you know, working for P&G, where they would have three children, da 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 da. And I gave them a check, and I said, if he takes the deposit money, here is, you give them your check, and here's my check to reimburse you. So I first went there at 11 o'clock, and they got there about 3:30. And he welcomed them, embraced them with open arms, and said, yes, they can have the apartment. And he was so glad to see them because a colored girl had wanted it, and he doesn't want to rent to colored people. So he was just sabotaging himself then. So we had dinner, the couple and I, we had dinner, and I decided to write down everything that had happened. And by Monday morning, I had found me a lawyer who was willing to take this case. That was on a Saturday. On Sunday night, he called the testers out to see if they really still wanted the apartment, because he really didn't want to rent to colored people. And so Monday morning, we were in court. Wow. The lawyer was in court. He said I had a good case. And being a business manager by now, I had written out everything, the sequence of things, and had all the evidence there, and had my testers ready to testify. So within a week, we had won the case. I think I got $15,000.
And an apartment?
Well, yes and no. The lawyer negotiated my getting this apartment. But in doing so, he wrote up a lease that was awful. My kids had to come in the back door, and they couldn't play on the front porch. And this, that, and the other. I was really surprised that the lawyer would even consent to, you know, such restrictions. So I told him, no, I wouldn't lease the apartment under those conditions. So we backed out of that lease, but I did get the money, which enabled me then to buy a house when I got transferred to Green Bay. So that was interesting. It's the first time that I ever pursued a discrimination suit, though there are so many instances in my life that I could have done so. But you pick your battles and hope that you can, that you pick the right ones. Gracie, what are you doing? You just have to let me know that you're here, right? Okay. So where are we now?
So Green Bay, PC trainer, but you felt isolated.
Oh, yeah.
In Green Bay.
Yeah. No place to raise a family. No place for a single woman to be.
Why did you get divorced, if I may ask?
While I was in Green Bay, 1983 probably. So I left Green Bay and my business to come to work for Wisconsin Power and Light Company. It's called Alon Energy now. And I was head of its PC unit there. Then I left there to start to go in business again for myself with PC training. And that paid off handsomely for me. I trained at hospitals, the state of Wisconsin, not too many private businesses, school systems. I wrote my own curriculum materials. It was a brand new field, so.
And this was training people to use PCs?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Back at that time, people didn't know how to turn on a PC. You had the ubiquitous, what did they call it? I can't think of it now. But you had no menus or anything like that.
Right.
You just had what they call a C-prompt.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Remember those days?
Well, my husband started in IT.
Okay.
As a computer tech emotionally and all that.
Right.
So, yeah, there was a time when he felt godlike.
right. That's not true today.
No.
Because, but back then, you taught people the basics, like turn on the computer and don't be afraid of it. But I combined my teaching experience, because I taught early on in Boston, and my business experience to develop this business. I write the curriculum, I write the books. The books that you see on the shelves now, Lotus, Excel, WordPerfect, Office, I would write that material myself. And that was fine. I did that for 2 or 3 years. And then the city of Madison, again, offered me a job as a PC trainer with Madison Metro. I was their computer consultant with Madison. Their IT, by now it's called IT department. So I would manage the programs that control the signs on the bus. Or that control the coins that came through the token boxes. And I did some training in the software programs.
So that means you were back here in Madison by the mid to late 80s?
No, I came back here, I think, in 88. And by 90, I think, I had started with Umoja. Umoja was a... Somebody else really started Umoja. And I asked them, could I help them? It was just a single folded over sheet with Umoja on the front and some calendar events on the inside. It's a yellow piece of paper. A lot of people remember that. They didn't want me to help them with it, but when the couple got ready to leave town, I asked them if I could continue Umoja, and they said yes. So that's how I got into Umoja. And at that time, I knew I wanted it to be bigger and better than what was on the table. So what I did is I went to the university, and every course they had in publishing, magazine writing, journalism, graphics, whatever pertained to the production of, at that time it was a newsletter. I took that course. I took about 12 courses. They used to be offered by UW Extension. They were either 1 day or 2 day courses. Because I was determined, I had in my mind that black people shouldn't be misrepresented as criminals and athletes as their only measure of success. And that I could see that the Cap Times and the State Journal didn't have a clue as to what I was talking about, and they weren't going to change. So I decided to take this little newsletter and let it be the voice that represented black people in a positive way. After about, I stayed at the bus company, I think, 3 or 4, maybe 5 years, while I would do Umoja on the side. And finally I decided that I wanted to do Umoja full time. And then that's when I transformed it into a magazine. at least I had aspirations for that. I had to learn how to do it. One of the first decisions I made was about the cover, having art on the cover, because I could tell that I didn't have the money or the studio experience in photography to have a person on the cover. So I decided to ask black artists to let me use their work, whatever they had produced and I liked, as a cover for my magazine. And that's how I got it converted to a magazine. I don't know whether your exhibit had some of the early emojis.
Mm-hmm.
Or the newsletter kind of thing.
Yes. Before you had the art.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You did. My first art piece, probably not the first, but one of the early ones was, I had gone down to Chicago to the DuSable Museum. Always has a summer festival and art show down there. And I was walking around the grounds, looking at the different vendors and their art displays. And I saw this piece of art, and I loved it so much. And the DuSable art, the grounds for the festival grounds are huge. But I must have gone back to that table two or three times. And I bought a piece of the art. And then when I got back to Madison, I said, how am I going to find this person? Well, we had some internet capability at that time. I think it was mid-90s. Or I got his address anyway. I can't remember the name of the artist right now. But I finally found him in Canada. And I asked him if I could use his art on the cover of my magazine. Now, this was just an embryonic idea then. I didn't know what I was doing. My printer didn't know how to do it. You know, it was just a raw concept. And he said yes. So we got that piece of art. You know, I think in one of these bedrooms, his original picture is there.
Wow.
I don't think I put it in the exhibition collection, is what I'm saying. Mm. So anyway, and from then on, I would find an artist somewhere. And select something for my cover. I learned to go to black art shows in Philadelphia, New York, and Chicago. Talk to the artists there. Beg them to let me use their work. Of course, they're very protective of their work because they don't want to be exploited. So we had to get through that hassle. I relied a lot on the local people, local artists I knew. One was connected with the school system. She taught art. And she's done a number of interesting pieces for me. And it's another one. He works at the university in admissions. But he loves painting. It's his first love. He has done almost all of the President Obama pieces for me. Jerry Jordan. Henry Hawkins taught in the school system until he retired. He's an excellent portrait painter. He did a W.E.B. Du Bois for me. So my local artists tend to do something specifically for Umoja. The national artists, I just find a piece of work or one or two works that I like and ask them if I can use them. And by and large, they've been cooperative. So that's how the art covers came about. And I was glad I did that because I could find a graphic artist who could handle the artwork. And I could pay them their fee was within my budget. To try to get a good photographer, it's very expensive. So I was glad I didn't go that route.
Do you need to know what time it is?
I do.
It's a little after one.
Okay. So maybe one more thing for today, if I can. And that's the role that students have played in, and not UW-Madison students necessarily, but it seems like from the emojis I've read, there's a strong influence of student, either student work or student writing, or at least focusing on students.
Well, probably focusing on student. I haven't had much student writing.
Okay.
Yeah. Every year I do two issues devoted to students. One is college graduates, and the other one is high school graduates. And that's been a niche that I've been able to engage in. And I do that for a couple of reasons. Number one, education has always been an important part of my life. And back then, when this adopted family, my adopted family, took me in, they stressed education. Of course, they sent me to this little small college in Alabama. This is where you're going. Go. And so that has been a major influence in my life. Of course, I taught at Florida A&M University. We went to Boston so Jim could get his master's degree there. And then we came to UW. So I spent a lot of time on college campuses. So that's one major factor. The other one is that I want our young people to know that in our community we have a tradition of valuing education and that we are proud of them. So this is, I try to find every black student on campus and every high school graduate so that their name gets in UMOJA, and then I do some profile stories on a selected number. And those are always popular issues. And the State Journal puts out this special insert for the paper of the top high school graduates throughout, I know it was throughout Wisconsin or just here in Dane County. Mm-hmm. Never, a black kid never appears there. So this is our salute to our graduates. The parents are probably more proud than anyone, but then I used to have a called one for teenagers and one for elementary students. What did I call that call? Anyway, it was where I would put the spotlight on a kid who did volunteer work or who was doing well in high school. I did that maybe for 10 or 15 years. Anyway, some of those students say today, Miss Malele, you remember, a child of the month, that's what I call it, teen of the month, a child of the month. And they still remember that.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. They're grown with their own children now.
Of course.
Children, of course, are our future. That's a cliche, but it's true. And I have tried to do so many stories on successful people to give our children a sense of who they can follow and who their role model should be. Did I ever tell you my favorite story about UMOJA?
I don't think you did.
Seems like I did, but when I get into it, you can tell me if you've heard it before. I was sitting here. I stopped by a school one day, the local elementary school, not too far from here. to get some details on a story I was writing. The school is very old and isn't handicap friendly. So as I was struggling up the steps, this black girl, she was probably 9 or 10, said, "Can I help you?" I really didn't need her help, but I said, you know, she has good training from home or school, so yes, you can help me. And we did our small talk about what grade are you in, what's your name, you know, what's your favorite subject. We got to the top of the stairs, and she says, "Now, who are you?" And I said, "Have you ever heard of Umoja magazine?" This kid jumped to the ceiling and said, "That's my favorite magazine. I just love Umoja." I started blushing, and then I almost cried because she has so much enthusiasm. "This is, oh, I read Umoja all the time. I can't wait to get it." And so this is an elementary school, so she can't be any more than 10, 11, or 12. Right. She said she was in the 5th grade. Then she proceeded to walk me down the hallway and tell everybody this is the publisher of Umoja. Well, nobody else cared, really, but her. So I thought, well, if I've not influenced anybody, I've influenced her. I don't know where she is today. She's probably in the 10th or 11th grade. I didn't get her name. I was so overwhelmed by her enthusiasm for Umoja.
That's great.
So it made a difference in her life.
And yours.
Yeah. You know, it's enough one on a day when nothing goes right that encourages you. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And
well, I think, I should speak for myself. I probably need to head back to the office.
Okay.
But is there something on your mind you want to make sure we get on the recording before we wrap it up?
Mm-hmm.
You think you'll be back again?
I think I need to come back one more time.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm fine.
Okay.
I'm comfortable.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, this concludes the second interview, so thank you very much.
Okay.